We're going to talk about In the Mood, Optimizing Diagnosis and Treatment of Bipolar Depression. How did you enjoy that focuser? I guess enjoyment's not the right word. It was very impactful, wasn't it? Yeah. So we've all been there. We've all had patients who we didn't quite know what exactly was going on, and they end up in trouble, usually without that music in the background, which I found quite disturbing. But anyhow, we're going to talk about bipolar depression, how to identify it and how to treat it. We're going to implement best practices for identifying bipolar depression, and we're going to use evidence-based strategies to enhance treatment for bipolar depression. So let's start by acknowledging a truth here. You're probably seeing a lot more bipolar depression patients than you realize. We often make mistakes. I do this all the time in terms of misidentifying someone for confusing MDD with bipolar depression, because they look kind of the same. And unless we have the additional information, it's really very difficult. Sometimes it's pretty easy to make a correct diagnosis when they come into your office with a placard around their neck saying, "Hi, I have a history of mania," but most don't. And you have to dig this information out somehow. It's difficult because patients aren't always forthcoming about their prior history of mania or hypomania because they don't realize it as anything, you know, remarkable to talk about. But family members do, and they'll tell you more. And that'll make it easier to actually identify bipolar depression. We'll get into that. So let's talk about a diagnostic conundrum. Peter, he's a 25-year-old man with a history of MDD since adolescence. No known history of mania or hypomania. Now, this is a little unusual here. MDD since adolescence. Right away, that should trigger some question marks in our heads. This is a rather unusual presentation for plain vanilla major depressive disorder. His most recent major depressive episode was treated with an SSRI, but he didn't get better. He was switched to his SNRI, but he didn't get better. Bupropion was added, but he didn't get better. And the decision was made, well, he probably has treatment-resistant depression. After all, he's been on these antidepressants and didn't get better, and he's being referred for esketamine nasal spray at a treatment center. Well, a second opinion was obtained, and it turns out there was a family history of bipolar disorder. Okay, well, that's important information. A family history of bipolar disorder would sort of push us more in the direction that we're not dealing with major depressive disorder at all. We're dealing with bipolar disorder. And then we get more history when we actually ask Peter. He would go without sleep for a few days, pulled all-nighters. He didn't need to sleep. He was full of energy. And this was not consistent from semester to semester. He thought this wasn't worth mentioning. After a therapeutic alliance was established and he felt more comfortable, he also talked about gambling and sexual promiscuity. These topics aren't really brought up when you first meet someone in an assessment for the very first time in your office. It's kind of embarrassing to talk about some of these things, and they don't get discussed until a therapeutic alliance is established and people feel comfortable with that. So now he's diagnosed with something different. Bipolar disorder, depressed. He doesn't have MDD at all. So bipolar depression is defined by having major depressive episodes and manic or hypomanic episodes. Bipolar type 1 is when there's a history of mania. Bipolar type 2 when there's a history of hypomania and no mania. Just hypomania. The Diet Coke of mania. It's actually pretty bad too because it can interfere with relationships as well. It just doesn't require hospitalization, doesn't reach the point of severe interference, and it doesn't it doesn't lead to psychosis at all as well. And on cross-sectional examination, though, when we think about a major depressive episode, we can't tell the difference between bipolar depression and major depressive disorder. Can't. The definition is the same. MDE, major depressive episode. In the DSM, it's the same criteria whether you have bipolar disorder, bipolar depression, or major depressive disorder. The difference is that history of mania or hypomania. Now, patients often don't have very much insight into their mania or hypomania. You've seen that. But they do have insight for depression, and they'll make an appointment to see you for their depression. I've never had a patient phone me, "Dr. Citrome, I'm acutely manic. I'd like to make an appointment to see you." That has never happened. And I've been in practice for a long time. but I do get calls of people who are depressed. Now, there are some aspects about bipolar disorder that are actually quite alarming, and that is the excess deaths that are attributable to having this disorder, probably because of under-recognition and under-treatment. But there is, in addition to suicide risk, which was amply described in the focuser, there's also cardiovascular risk, double compared to the general population. I'm sure you've heard this before, and you've heard about the nexus between mood disorders and inflammation, and the two are often coexisting, and actually having bipolar disorder is bad news, cardiovascular-wise. Now, the risk of suicide, coming back to that for a moment, it's twice as likely than those with major depressive disorder. Attempts are twice as lethal. Now, that knife that that gentleman was holding was pretty scary looking. And it didn't quite make sense to me that it was not a lethal attempt with a knife that size. But I guess he didn't put it in a place that would kill himself, but it was a suicide attempt and he survived. Very often when I've encountered situations like this, these attempts actually are successful with lethal means. Some risk factors about suicide you need to keep in mind is the earlier the age of onset, the higher the risk. The number of depressive episodes, the higher the risk. Comorbidities with alcohol use, higher the risk. History of antidepressant-induced mania. Well, that may be a confound, but it also is a risk. Family history of suicide or suicidal behavior and impulsivity. So these are the things we need to watch out for. Misdiagnosis, though, is very common, as you know. Up to 70% of people with bipolar disorder are misdiagnosed initially. The most common misdiagnosis is major depressive disorder. It can take 3.5 diagnoses and 4 clinicians before receiving the right diagnosis on average. Comorbidity can be very confusing. At least half have a comorbid condition. Now, if it happens to be substance use, then we wonder, did the substance use give the impression that the person is manic and they're not really manic at all? It's they're under the influence of a substance. Or is it they're trying to treat themselves for an altered mood state? Or is it just plain old comorbidity? Some other comorbidities are anxiety, and then, of course, obesity and cardiovascular disease. An interesting statistic is about 1 in 5 primary care patients who are depressed and who are receiving antidepressants actually have bipolar 1 or bipolar 2 disorder. I think you may have heard this statistic before. It is kind of alarming because antidepressants like SSRIs or SNRIs are not approved to treat bipolar depression. If you make the wrong diagnosis, you'll give the incorrect treatment. You'll provide an incorrect prognosis, and you'll encounter poor outcomes. So no antidepressant is actually approved for the treatment of bipolar depression, with the exception of fluoxetine in combination with olanzapine. That's like that special case. But no monotherapy antidepressant like an SSRI or SNRI is approved for bipolar depression. Antidepressant monotherapy can destabilize someone with bipolar depression. If you have induction of mania or hypomania or rapid cycling, well, that's icing to the cake, isn't it? So the most benign outcome of giving an antidepressant to someone with bipolar depression is that it doesn't do very much. But 1 out of 200 may become manic. Avoiding mania is one of my biggest goals for my patients. Someone in the throes of a manic episode has a good possibility of creating a problem at work, in their marriage, in their other social relationships. It can wreck lives. Antidepressants don't actually confer any treatment advantage even when you add them to a regimen for the treatment of bipolar disorder, either acutely or for an enduring response. So I'm not a big fan of using antidepressants in people with bipolar disorder, but I never say never, because yes, I have prescribed antidepressants for some people with bipolar disorder, never as a monotherapy, and only in the situation where they seem to be better when you add it and you take it away, they seem to be worse, you give it back to them, they seem to be better. This is the N-of-1 study, which actually overrides any other data that you have. Now, some clues I find very helpful to avoid misdiagnosis can be categorized in terms of family history, course of illness, treatment response, and associated features in those rough buckets. So family history, higher rates of psychiatric illness, and in particular, bipolar disorder. Course of illness, younger age of onset and number of recurrent episodes. Abrupt onset and abrupt end of depressive episodes, like a light switch. This is not the usual course for major depressive disorder. If they have more sleep and more appetite, I think of bipolar depression. Now, of course, you can have these alterations in people with MDD, but typically we would expect insomnia and decreased appetite in someone with MDD. With bipolar depression, it's like the reverse. It's atypical vegetative symptoms. So that's the answer to that question there. If you have hypersomnia and or increased appetite, that's something to think about. It's not diagnostic, but it's a clue. Treatment response is a good clue. Suboptimal response outcome with antidepressants like our Peter, our case patient. Antidepressant-induced mania or hypomania. The DSM now allows us to use that as part of the diagnostic criteria, DSM-5. Of course, that history of manic symptoms or the presence of manic symptoms is a giveaway. That's like the placard around a patient's neck saying, "Hi, I have bipolar disorder." Associated features, really chaotic relationships and job environments. So let's say someone's been married 5-6 times in 5-6 years. That's a little unusual. What if they change jobs 2-3 times a year? That's also quite unusual. Substance use, of course, people with MDD can also have substance use disorders, but perhaps more so if you have bipolar disorder. In terms of treatment of bipolar disorder, we have a lot of choices for acute mania and almost as many choices for long-term maintenance, but only 4 choices today for bipolar depression. Olanzapine-fluoxetine combination, quetiapine, lorazepam, cariprazine. That's it, those 4. Maybe in the not-too-distant future, we'll have lumateperone. It's in front of the FDA for a decision coming up for bipolar depression. But right now, these are the only 4 we have. It's very, very limited. But they all are very different from each other. So I'm kind of happy I have these choices because I can't pick and choose. In 2003, we only had 1, olanzapine-fluoxetine combination. Now we have 4, so that's better, right? 4 is better than 1. But it's not nearly the same number of choices as we have for acute mania. Now, olanzapine-fluoxetine combination was tested in psychotic bipolar depressed patients as well. So we have more information about that kind of patient with OFC. Quetiapine immediate and extended release. Well, quetiapine was tested in bipolar type 2 patients too. So we have information there. Lurasidone, well, that was tested in combination also with lithium or valproate. So we have additional data for that. And cariprazine, well, that was tested as a monotherapy and was tested in bipolar type 1. So there is actually a different body of evidence for each of these choices. Well, that may make us think about them a little differently as well. Now, lamotrigine is not approved for acute bipolar depression. Not approved. It's approved for bipolar maintenance. It wasn't quite robust enough to be approved for bipolar depression. Aripiprazole or ziprasidone are also not approved for bipolar depression. Actually, those trials failed to demonstrate efficacy. So now you know the answer to that other question. SSRIs, SNRIs, although approved for MDD, are not approved for acute bipolar depression. Okay, now that we got that out of the way, how do we interpret the data that's presented to us about these various approved treatments? Treatments can decrease symptoms based on a rating scale. The Montgomery-Åsberg Depression Rating Scale, for example, is one of those scales. Now, how many here have used the MADRS in your clinical practice? So a few hands go up. How about the PHQ-9? More hands go up. So you're free to also use the mattress if you so desire, but you will have to ask the questions and then write in your scores for each of these items on the mattress, 10 items. It's not that difficult. There's a structured interview to do it. It is feasible. You can ask these questions anyway in your clinical practice. Or you can do the PHQ-9, where you give it to the patient, they fill it out, you take a look at it. That's probably more efficient. But no matter what, you should do something to measure symptoms. In clinical trials, this is essential in order to determine if a drug is going to be superior to placebo. And you can see the different curves over time for placebo and active medication and changes in a rating scale score, and you can see, whoa, look, there's a difference there. But so what? Is this clinically relevant or not? We need to answer that question. We're going to use the rubric or model of evidence-based medicine. It involves your clinical judgment, relevant scientific evidence, and the patient's values and preferences. So your brain, your patient's brain, and keeping up with new information and making sense of it. This is not a cookbook. Now raise your hand if you recognize this guy. Okay, people of a certain age, all right. TV fans, okay. So if you're wondering, what is he showing here? What is this? Ask me afterwards. But those who are in on my little joke, I hope you appreciate it. No, not a cookbook. So what is an effect size? An effect size describes how important a treatment can possibly be. And is it useful to consider for your practice? It's not the same as a p-value. A p-value of less than 0.001 does not mean the result would be any more clinically relevant than if the p-value was less than 0.05. It really doesn't matter what the p-value is. The lower the p-value does not mean the result is more important clinically. It just means we're more kind of confident that what we're seeing is the truth. But the truth may not be important. Statistical significance doesn't tell us anything about the size of the treatment effect. Effect sizes are a different matter, and they'll tell us how to evaluate a statistically significant result, help us determine if this is something that we should consider for our day-to-day use in our office. Effect sizes can be described as a point change on a rating scale or in standard deviation units, that is, standardized mean difference. So point change is one way. Standardized deviation units, standard deviation units, that's a SMD, standardized mean difference. Another way to describe it is patient units. Number needed to treat, number needed to harm. So number needed to treat, how many patients would you need to treat with one intervention instead of the other before you would expect to encounter one additional outcome that you would desire, like one additional responder, one additional remitter. So if I see it every 3 patients for drug versus placebo, hey, that's pretty good. I'm going to get success pretty routinely. So that's the positive. There's also the negative. So the evil Spock here from the alternate universe. How many recognize the evil Spock? Okay, more than the not a cookbook reference. Okay. So number needed to harm is how many patients would you need to treat with intervention A versus intervention B or placebo before you'd expect to encounter one additional outcome that you would rather avoid, like one additional patient who gained at least 7% of their initial body weight, or one additional patient who experiences akathisia or sedation. So you have the good and the bad. We want to encounter the good more often than the bad, and NNT and NNH can actually describe this. It's actually pretty easy to calculate. So let me take you through this formula, because this is something everyone in this room can do without a calculator. In order to determine what is the NNT or NNH for any outcome that you're interested in, comparing drug A versus drug B or drug A versus placebo, all you need to know are the frequencies of these outcomes. You subtract that, and then you take 1 divided by that difference. I used to say reciprocal, but that scared people. I don't know why, but it does. 1 divided by that difference. We're always going to round up to the next higher whole number because we want to be conservative here. We don't want to exaggerate effect sizes. So remember, you know, the lower the number, the more often we'll encounter that outcome. So if we round down, we may be exaggerating a difference when a difference actually wouldn't be that as often. So I'm going to actually illustrate that with a concrete example. Let's say drug A results in remission 50% of the time. Drug B results in remission 20% of the time. Someone may say to you, hey, A is 2.5 times better than B, because 50 divided by 20 is 2.5 times better. Does that mean you'll have 2.5 times more success using one or the, you know, using that drug in your day-to-day practice? No, it doesn't really answer that question. That's the relative difference. What we need is the absolute difference. How often will we actually have an advantage? So we calculate NNT. 50% minus 20% is 30%. 30 goes into the number 100 3.3 times. We round it up to 4. For every 4 people that we would give drug A to instead of B, we would encounter one additional remitted patient. That's actually pretty good. And I'm going to use A instead of B most of the time. Unless, of course, that person has been on drug A before and it didn't work, or it has a side effect that they could not tolerate, or it's not on the formulary. Otherwise, A is the winner. Basically, any NNT versus placebo in a randomized controlled trial done for drug approval, any NNT less than 10 is acceptable. It tells us that we're going to find this intervention useful in day-to-day practice. An NNT versus placebo less than 5 is even better. That's unusual. We don't have very many treatments where that's the case. It is impossible to have an NNT of 1, which means your treatment will always work and the alternative will never work. Very few treatments have an NNT versus placebo of 2 or 3. One example are medicines for acute agitation, and another one is the avoidance of relapse in a 2-year period, taking an antipsychotic or not. Many treatments have an NNT versus placebo of 7 to 10, especially newer agents where the clinical trials have demonstrated a actually impressively high placebo response rate. You know, being in a clinical trial doesn't mean you're not getting any benefit when you're on placebo. You're being treated very nicely. You're getting PRNs, you're getting regular, you know, in a hospital you get your meals. You even get paid for your participation. You will get better. But those who are randomized to the active medicine have a more robust response. But it does actually make the effect size look less impressive than otherwise they would be. So we see this with cariprazine for bipolar depression, vortioxetine for major depressive disorder, brexpiprazole for acute schizophrenia, 3 new agents in the era of high placebo rates where the NNT is like 7 to 10. Now, NNH, number needed to harm, we want that number to be as high as possible. An NNH versus placebo of greater than 10 is, you know, okay. I wish it was greater than 20. That would be even better. If it's 50 or 100, well, I'm really not going to think about that harm as being important. Except there may be some different, you know, points of view if that harm is death or mania. Then I'm going to be actually concerned about an NNH of 100 or 200 if the outcome that I'm talking about is death or mania. Some NNHs may be clinically irrelevant, even if they're relatively small, less than 10, for example, if the outcome is mild dry mouth. So we have to use our brains here and figure out what would be clinically relevant or important to the patient that we're treating. The bottom line is low values for NNT is what we want. High values for NNH is also part of the package of a desired intervention. Low NNT, high NNH. You'll encounter the therapeutic response more often than the adverse event. Now, likelihood to be helped or harmed is the ratio of NNH to NNT, and you want that greater than 1, because mathematically speaking, that means you're going to encounter the benefit more often than the harm. So low NNT, high NNH, LHH greater than 1, and that's the answer to the third question. Now, the LHH business is a little more complicated. because garbage in, garbage out. If we don't have a statistically significant outcome that we're measuring, like for an adverse event, it doesn't make that much sense to do this. But it's an intellectual exercise, and we take NNH to NNT, we can sort of figure out how much more often are we going to encounter response or remission compared to an outcome we'd rather avoid, like stopping the drug because of an adverse event, or having an extra patient complaining of sedation, and so on. Now, the outcomes of interest that I'm going to show you in the next 2 minutes are: what is the NNT for response on the MADRS? That is, a 50% or greater reduction from baseline to endpoint is response. Or MADRS remission, which is a total score of less than or equal to 12 or less than or equal to 10 at endpoint. We want these numbers to be as low as possible, these NNTs. NNH we want as large as possible. Greater than 7% weight gain is something we want to avoid. An adverse event of sedation or somnolence we want to avoid. Akathisia we want to avoid. Basically, any AE that we want to avoid for that individual patient, you can calculate the NNH for. You have the percentages in the product label. You subtract them. You see how many times it goes into the number 100. You round up and you have your NNH. Let's take a look at MADRS responders first for cariprazine, lurasidone, quetiapine, and olanzapine fluoxetine combination, 10, 5, 6, and 4. Okay, these interventions work. The responder rates versus placebo are illustrated up at the top, showing you that there's great variety in terms of placebo response that makes comparisons a little wonky. But I have the 95% confidence intervals here. Those are these vertical lines with the caps at the top and the bottom, and they all overlap. So I would say these four interventions are pretty close in terms of efficacy, close enough for government work, as we used to say. And okay, these work, MADRS response. MADRS remission, now the threshold for the definition of remission differs from trial to trial a little bit. But for cariprazine, lurasidone, quetiapine, and olanzapine fluoxetine combination, 11, 7, 6, and 5, the 95% confidence intervals overlap, so I would say they're roughly equivalent there too. But the NNH versus placebo differs. So here's the heat map. Green means go. Green means NNH of greater than or equal to 20. Really a lower risk, I'm not going to be worried about it. A yellow means caution, intermediate risk, an NNH of 10 to 19, and red means higher risk, NNH less than 10. So to illustrate what I mean by that, look at the red for somnolence and quetiapine. That's an NNH of 3. For every 3 patients randomized to quetiapine instead of placebo in the clinical trials, there was an additional patient with a complaint of somnolence. Every 3. That's actually more often than response or remission. You're actually going to encounter somnolence more often than response or remission with quetiapine. With the olanzapine fluoxetine combination, the red is weight gain of at least 7%. There, the NNH is 6. Roughly the same as the NNT for response or remission. You will encounter weight gain of at least 7% for OFC as often as you would response or remission, roughly speaking. Now you'll notice that for the lower dose of cariprazine and the lower dose of lurasidone is basically a sea of green, which means these are more tolerable choices. But we need to use our brains. We need to think about these adverse events more thoughtfully. What about the time to onset of this adverse event versus the time to onset of a therapeutic response? How much is it going to screw up, you know, getting our patients better and willing to continue this treatment? What about the severity and duration of this AE? That has to be considered too. The AE may be completely irrelevant if it's not serious and doesn't last very long. And despite their challenges, OFC and quetiapine may be the right drug for your patient if that's what worked in the past. And there's high urgency here that we need to give something that works for them. More considerations. Off-label choices like lamotrigine and antidepressants, almost never as a monotherapy, may have utility in low urgency situations or when there's a past history that they did well on it. Some limitations, I mentioned this earlier. These four choices that are FDA approved for bipolar depression were studied in somewhat different ways. The study populations differed a little bit. Quetiapine included bipolar type 2. OFC included psychotic patients. Lurasidone included a study of lithium or valproate combined with lurasidone. The durations of the studies also differed a little bit, 6 weeks versus 8 weeks, and you can make the argument that, you know, it is not fair to compare an 8-week trial with a 6-week trial, so, well, we do our best there. Success will depend, though, ultimately on you making an accurate diagnosis. So we have to remember that major depressive episodes differ in the sense of that history. And MDEs associated with bipolar disorder are treated differently from MDEs associated with MDD. Wrong diagnosis, wrong treatment. In fact, you can make someone worse. Patients who are incorrectly treated will have persistent symptoms. Never say never, so I just want to emphasize this. If your individual patient did better on drug X and worse off drug X, give drug X. But if you don't have that information and you don't know, we'll have to use the information that has been collected through clinical trials and figure this out. So my last couple of slides is evidence-based or not, you decide. Ms. A, age 20, presents with a major depressive episode. She's depressed, so you prescribe an SSRI. Is this evidence-based? Why or why not? No, it's not evidence-based. The MDE may be because of bipolar disorder and not MDD, and you need additional information. Now, if we'd had additional information, we may change our mind here, but just on basis of what I said, this would not be an evidence-based intervention. Well, let's say 3 years ago, she had a hypomanic episode that spontaneously resolved. So we know she has bipolar disorder. 2 years ago, she had an MDE that was treated successfully with an SSRI without any emergence of hypomania. So we prescribe an SSRI. Is this evidence-based? Why or why not? Why or why not? It actually is evidence-based. According to our rubric of using your clinical judgment, your patient's values and preferences, and acknowledgement that what the patient has undergone and experienced will override anything else. So individual values and preferences together with the clinical judgment makes this evidence-based practice based on how EBM was initially formulated, not a cookbook. So your brain, your patient's brain, keeping up with new information, making sense of it, is what EBM, evidence-based medicine, is all about.